Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Center for American Progress call, previewing the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals hearing on emergency stay. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the comments over to Marshall Fitz. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you all for taking the time to join us for today's call. My name, as Mark said, is Marshall Fitz. I'm the Vice President of Immigration Policy here at the Center for American Progress, and I am excited to be joined on the call by two really brilliant legal scholars. First is Stephen Legomski, who's a law professor at Washington University School of Law and a former chief counsel at USCIS. And our second speaker is Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow here at CAP and our resident legal and constitutional expert. So here's how this call is going to go. I'm going to try to kick things off with a brief bit of background about where things stand in the Texas lawsuit that has challenged the 2014 DACA and DAPA programs, as well as what's at stake in the litigation. Then I'm going to turn it to Steve, who's going to talk a little bit about why we think that there is strong legal authority for the DACA and DAPA policies, and to talk more specifically about why a recently decided case in the Fifth Circuit should dictate how the court rules on the Texas lawsuit. Steve and I just published an issue brief on that question yesterday, and hopefully you've all received that. Then we're going to hear from Ian, who's looked at the prior rulings and the judicial backgrounds of both the district judge who issued the preliminary injunction and the circuit judges who are going to hear all the oral arguments tomorrow, and we'll share his thoughts and concerns about those judges and the impact that conservative judicial activism is having on policies that affect millions of Americans today. At that point, we're going to open it up to you all for a Q&A. But first, let me just quickly go through the procedural posture of the case, which is, in fact, a complete morass. So I'm going to try and simplify where things stand. As a reminder, the former Attorney General, now Governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, filed a lawsuit late last year seeking to block two policies announced by DHS on November 20th. The two challenged policies were the expansion of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Program, or DACA, and the creation of the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans Program, or DAPA. On February 16th, just 2 days before the expansion of DACA was set to go into effect, a federal district judge, Andrew Hannon from the Southern District of Texas, issued a preliminary injunction blocking implementation of those Deferred Action policies nationwide. Immediately afterward, the Department of Justice filed an emergency motion asking the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to stay the effect of that injunction. DOJ in that motion is essentially asking the Court of Appeals to allow the programs to go into effect while the litigation over the validity of the injunction continues. The hearing scheduled for tomorrow in New Orleans is on that emergency stay request. On a separate track, the federal government has also appealed the preliminary injunction ruling itself. Briefing has begun on that appeal, but no hearing has been scheduled yet. So just to be super clear, tomorrow's hearing is more narrowly focused on the question of whether the policies should be going into effect while the litigation continues. That said, given all of the briefing that has been done on the issues to date, and given that the Fifth Circuit has scheduled an extraordinary 2 hours of oral argument on the motion, it's almost certain that the merits of the lawsuit will be at the center of the debate tomorrow, and that includes the threshold question of whether Texas and the other states even have standing to challenge the policies in the first place. Our unequivocal view is that this lawsuit should be dismissed because the legal basis for the DACA and DAPA policies is strong and well-established, and the precedent for these policies extends back over 60 years. That view, as I think Steve will discuss, was only reinforced by a unanimous ruling issued last week that also came out of the Fifth Circuit in the case of Crane versus Napolitano. But as we've seen too often, judges are not always the neutral arbiters of the law that we expect them to be. Indeed, that is precisely why the Republican state officials who filed this lawsuit did so specifically in Judge Hannon's court. They believed, based on intemperate remarks in prior cases, that Judge Hannon was ideologically predisposed to oppose DHS's DACA and DAPA policies and that he would be sympathetic to their arguments. He did not disappoint. He issued a lengthy diatribe styled as an opinion in support of his preliminary injunction. And as we'll hear from Ian, two of the three judges on tomorrow's Fifth Circuit panel also have aggressively conservative ideological bents and have engaged in significant judicial activism of their own. Now, the point I want to make here very clearly is that this case was meritless from the beginning. This was a political dispute over policy dressed up as a legal challenge. And if the panel follows the law, there really is only one conclusion it can reach, that the policies are simply not subject to legal challenge by the state of Texas. If, however, the panel rules otherwise and keeps the injunction in effect while the litigation continues, there will only be one explanation, and that's that this is a politically motivated ruling made by Republican political appointees to the bench based on a lawsuit filed by Republican lawmakers in pursuit of a partisan political agenda. Millions of American families will be left in limbo for one reason. Conservative extremists have taken to the courts in a last-ditch effort to hold those families and their lives and progress back. There will be no question who is to blame for that outcome because the community is watching and Spanish-language media is covering this every step of the way. So with that, let me just turn the mic, the proverbial mic, over to my colleague, Steve Ligonski. Steve?
Hey, thanks very much, Marshall. And Marshall has just described really nicely the procedural posture of the case and where we are now. Let me just say first that in terms of the general standard for getting a stay, a couple things to point out. One is that the courts have held that where the legal question that's presented is, quote, serious, and I don't think anyone denies that these legal questions are serious, the main thing the government has to show in order to get a temporary stay is that its case is, quote, substantial. It doesn't even have to show that it's more likely than not to succeed. Also, in cases where the government is challenging a nationwide injunction against the federal government, it's particularly easy for the federal government usually to get a stay because the idea is you can't have a situation in which one federal district judge with extreme views is allowed to shut down a whole federal program until higher courts have had a chance to weigh in on the case. So that's the standard. So that means that in order for Judge Hannon's order ultimately to survive, the Fifth Circuit would have to reach two conclusions. First, it would have to decide that Texas has legal standing to bring the suit in the first place. And second, it would have to decide that the government was legally required to use the APA, Administrative Procedure Act, notice and comment procedures for this policy announcement, because that was the basis for Judge Hannon's order. And therefore, if the government can make a serious case on either of those two issues, then the Fifth Circuit panel is obliged to grant a stay. My own view is that the government makes out not just a serious or substantial case, but a compelling one, and not just on one of those issues, which is all it has to do, but actually on both. And I believe, as Marshall was just saying, that was true even before the Fifth Circuit decided the Crane case last week. The Crane decision makes the government's position even stronger, and here's why. First off, on the standing issue. In order to have standing to sue, the general rule is the plaintiff has to be able to show that the defendant's actions would harm it in some concrete way. Now, Texas made a very clever argument here. It points out that under Texas law, people who receive deferred action from the federal government are eligible for driver's licenses. And then it goes on to say that the driver's license application fees that it charges don't cover the full cost of its administrative processing. And therefore, it says the more people who apply for driver's licenses, the more money it's going to lose. Judge Hannon credited that argument, but even before the Crane decision, I think there were several clear flaws in his reasoning. First off, the state's own budget documents seem to contradict its factual claims that it loses money on driver's licenses. Marshall can speak more knowledgeably to that point. Second, even if it does lose money, nobody is forcing Texas to subsidize the cost of processing driver's licenses. That's their choice. And third, this is the part that bothers me the most. Even if we were to accept that Texas can't avoid losing money on the driver's licenses, Judge Hannon's theory of standing is quite radical and would produce quite extreme results. And here's why. The federal immigration authorities grant millions of immigration applications of all kinds every year, not just deferred action. Under Judge Hannon's theory, any time any of those approvals have the effect of making somebody eligible for some benefit that the state chooses to give, the state would be able to tie up the agency's decision in court, and that theory is simply untenable. But the most important defect in Judge Hannon's reasoning on standing, I believe, is that he was willing to look at only one side of the ledger. He considered the fiscal costs that Texas claims it would incur, but he refused to consider the fiscal benefits. There are several empirical studies, including one by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which shows that deferred action will significantly increase tax revenues for several reasons that we can discuss later if you'd like. There was a further study prepared by the Center for American Progress that shows even more specifically that in Texas, in particular, the state would receive much more money in additional tax revenues than it would lose on driver's licenses. So in other words, Texas not only hasn't shown that these programs would cost the state money, it's clear that it would gain from them. And even that doesn't count all the other benefits to Texas's citizens for making sure that people who drive on their roads have been tested for driving skills and have liability insurance, which deferred action would not permit. So that's where the Fifth Circuit decision in Crane comes in. The standing argument by the state of Mississippi admittedly was not as precise as the one Texas has just made. But one of the Fifth Circuit's reasons applies equally to Texas. The Fifth Circuit said that in deciding standing, a court has to consider not only the fiscal costs, but also the fiscal benefits, and it's faulted Mississippi for having failed to do that. The court said that once you consider both costs and benefits, it's just as possible that the program will lead to a net reduction in the state's fiscal burden, which actually is the case in the case of the Texas suit. So in contrast, Judge Hannon's idea of a cost-benefit analysis is that all you look at are the costs. The Fifth Circuit has now said you can't do that. Now, as for the APA issue, the Fifth Circuit didn't have any occasion to address the APA issue directly because it wasn't raised, but it did something that completely undermines the whole premise, for Judge Hannon's APA theory. By way of background, the APA says that certain federal decisions have to go through an elaborate process that consists of publishing a proposed version of the rule in the Federal Register, then you invite the public to submit comments, then you respond to those comments, and then you can issue the final rule. This takes a very long time. However, under the APA and also under the Supreme Court opinions that interpret it, you don't have to go through this elaborate process if all you're doing is advising the public of how you plan to exercise a discretionary power. The key word here is discretionary, and agencies use that discretionary exemption all the time. And that, of course, is precisely what DACA and DAPA do. These programs are exercises of the Secretary's discretion to decide how best to allocate the limited enforcement resources that Congress has given him. Deferred action is one particular form of that discretion. And so the Secretary's memos specifically instruct the USCIS officers that they are to look at each individual case and figure out, first of all, whether the applicant meets the threshold criteria. And by the way, some of those criteria are themselves discretionary. For example, is the person too much of a national security threat? Does the person's criminal history pose too much of a public safety threat? And so on. But then, even if the person meets all of those discretionary and other threshold criteria, the officer then is to exercise discretion to decide whether DACA or DAPA should be granted or denied. Judge Hannon rejected all of this, even though that's exactly what the Secretary's memo says. He speculates that when it comes time to implement DAPA, which hasn't even begun yet, the USCIS officers are going to systematically disobey the Secretary's clear instruction to exercise discretion in each individual case. There is not a shred of evidence in the record to support the judge's speculation. And on that point, I would respectfully refer you to my own February 25th written testimony before the House Judiciary Committee, because that provides all the detail from the record and the case. And if you want the link to that testimony, it appears in endnote 29 of the CAP brief that you've all received. That's where the Fifth Circuit decision in Crane comes in again. The court there quoted at length from both Secretary Napolitano's original 2012 DACA memo and Secretary Johnson's 2014 memo on DACA and DAPA. And the court concluded these programs are indeed discretionary. The Crane court concluded that. They are not mandatory, as Judge Hannon was claiming. And that, of course, wipes out the entire premise of Judge Hannon's APA argument. So two conclusions from all this, and then I'll stop. First, Judge Hannon's theories for finding standing and for finding an APA violation both were on very shaky legal ground to begin with. And second, the Fifth Circuit decision in the Crane case further undermines both of his determinations. And as you might already know, one Court of Appeals panel is legally bound to follow the precedent decisions of previous panels of the same court. So that means that if the Fifth Circuit follows the law, it should reverse Judge Hannon's injunction, and even before that, it should grant a temporary stay that the government has requested. That's it for me.
Thank you very much, Steve. Ian?
Sure thing. All right. So my role is mostly to talk about the judges who will be hearing this case tomorrow. Before I get to that, I want to emphasize two points. I mean, one is to reemphasize a point that Steve just made, that it is extraordinary that we are in this position in the first place. The ordinary rule in federal litigation against the United States government is that a single district judge should not have the power to dictate U.S. policy. And so it is highly unusual that Hannon would issue an injunction against the entire United States and not stay that himself. You know, ordinarily, federal litigation against the Supreme Court, against the United States, proceeds to the Supreme Court before a nationwide injunction takes effect. The second point that I will make is that there is a divide that we have seen in immigration cases amongst Republican-appointed judges. You know, we saw this recently in Arizona v. U.S. That was the SB 1070 case out of Arizona. And that decision was decided actually just a few weeks after Obama announced DACA. The majority opinion in Arizona emphasized the broad discretion of executive branch officials on immigration, and of course Scalia's dissent not only said that Arizona should have sweeping power to enact restrictions on immigrants, but he also went out of his way to criticize the recent DACA order in his dissent. The reason I bring this up is that Roberts and Kennedy were both in the majority opinion. Kennedy actually wrote it in Arizona v. U.S. So what we've seen at the Supreme Court level is that amongst the Republican appointees there is a divide where some of them are more friendly to immigrants, some of them less so. We see the same divide on the Fifth Circuit. The most important recent immigration case out of the Fifth Circuit is a case called Villas at Parkside Partners v. City of Farmers Branch. And this was, although the breakdown of the judges was a little complicated, this was a 9-6 decision which struck down a city ordinance that was effectively designed to prevent undocumented immigrants from renting homes. If you wanted to rent a home in the City of Farmers Branch, you had to obtain a license, and then after you obtained a license, you had to there was supposed to be an investigation into whether or not you were in fact lawfully present, and if you were not, then there could be criminal charges brought against you. So it was an elaborate ploy to prevent undocumented immigrants from being able to find housing in this city. The Fifth Circuit struck it down. Again, it was a 7-6 decision. And that brings me to the bad news for the administration in this case, and that is that two of the judges who dissented in that case, again, it was a minority of the Fifth Circuit judges who dissented, and I believe all of them were Republicans. There were also some Republican appointees in the majority opinion. So we once again saw this divide amongst Republican-appointed judges. Two of the judges in dissent were Jerry Smith and Jennifer Elrod, both of whom are on this panel that will hear this case tomorrow. Now, a few more details about Smith and Elrod, and then by that point I'm sure you'll all be sick of hearing my voice. One is that Smith is probably one of the most flamboyantly conservative judges on the federal appeals bench. He once described feminists as, and this is a quote from Judge Smith, a gaggle of outcasts, misfits, and rejects. He once ordered the Department of Justice to write a letter explaining why a political statement by President Obama that Smith found objectionable. And of course, he once voted to allow a man to be executed despite the fact that the man's lawyer slept through much of his trial. So Smith is an extraordinarily conservative judge. He's a movement conservative judge. It would be very, very surprising if he rules with the Obama administration in this case. Elrod is less flamboyant, but is also very conservative. You may remember her as one of the few judges in America who's been spanked by the Supreme Court for being too anti-abortion. Elrod wrote the opinion reinstating some of Texas's abortion restrictions, and shortly after that, the Supreme Court temporarily blocked those restrictions in Texas. And Elrod also co-authored the dissent in Farmers Branch.
So it's an unfortunate draw for the administration here, you know, on a court where, based on the vote in Farmers Branch, they were mathematically likely to get judges who were more sympathetic to immigration. They got these two judges on the panel instead. I'll say one more thing, which is that, you know, as Marshall alluded to, this case has been a tribute to forum shopping. You know, forum shopping is the legal term for when lawyers are very intentional about where they file cases because they want to make sure that their case is heard by a friendly judge. Before Hannon even heard this case, Judge Hannon's the district judge who issued the injunction, he had a history of writing opinions calling for harsher immigration policies. One of them, he criticized the Obama administration for not charging a woman who crossed the border to reunite with her child with a felony. So that's his views. You cross the border to reunite with your children and you should be thrown in prison. So, you know, there's been a lot of unfortunate judicial assignments for the administration. I suspect that the Hannon assignment was intentional. The Fifth Circuit assignment is more random. And unfortunately, you know, that's probably going to bode well, not going to bode well, at least at this stage in the litigation, for the administration.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you both. It was really interesting, really illuminating stuff. Mark? I think we're ready to open up the line for questions.
Thank you very much. And for the members of our telephone audience, if you would like to ask a question today, you can do so by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please ensure that your mute function is off so we can receive your signal. And again, that is star 1 for a phone question. We'll pause one moment. At this time, we have our first response, and we'll hear from Minelis Negron, Univision.
Hello, it's actually Minelis Negron. Thank you for doing this conference call. I just have a quick question. If we don't hear a final decision tomorrow, which is, I think is not likely, what is going to happen next?
Well, I can take that, I guess. I mean, it's a good question. You know, we could hear, potentially we could hear tomorrow, although I think that that's really unlikely, you know, or it could be months. Like, you know, there really isn't any, like, particular way to force the court to decide this quickly. I suspect that the answer is going to be more like a few weeks than months. I mean, they have treated this in some way, you know, in some ways with attention to the fact that this is an emergency motion. And, you know, I think that the fact that the judges are treating this as if they view it as a very complex case indicates that they're not going to decide it overnight. But I think they're going to try to get to the out in a few weeks. The thing that may draw it out more is the fact that there is a third judge on the panel, Judge Higginson. Higginson is an Obama appointee and I think is much more likely to side with the Obama administration than Smith and Elrod are. And so whenever there's a majority opinion and a dissent, that tends to drag out the problem, that tends to drag out the amount of time it takes for the court to issue its decision.
Does that answer your question? Do you have a follow-up?
Actually, if I may, I just wanted to, you know, extend a little bit on that. We won't see it going back to Judge Hannon in Texas. If, you know, if anything, this is going to move forward to the Supreme Court, or what do you think is going to happen? I mean, is it going to be stuck in the Fifth Circuit, or what?
So there are still going to be proceedings in Judge Hannon's court. So there are essentially three things happening in parallel right now. One is there's the Department of Justice emergency request for a stay. That's what's being considered tomorrow. There is also an appeal of Hannon's decision asking the Fifth Circuit to reverse his decision issuing the preliminary injunction. That's going to be heard later this year. And then while this is going on, there is a full trial on the merits, and that trial is still ongoing, and that will be heard by Judge Hannon. So, you know, there are multiple tracks, and it's possible that each one of these tracks will eventually wind up in front of a different Fifth Circuit panel, So we don't know how the Fifth Circuit and potentially the Supreme Court will ultimately rule on these questions. But you know, there's basically three bites at the apple here, where a court could step in and say that Judge Hannon went too far.
Thank you.
Steve, did you have anything you wanted to add to that? Or?
No, I think Ian handled that very well. The only word of explanation I guess I would add maybe is that if the Fifth Circuit were ultimately to reverse Judge Hannon's preliminary injunction, not this panel, but the one that hears that makes the decision on the merits, then whether it goes back to Judge Hannon might depend on their reasons for doing so. If they were to hold that the state of Texas simply has no standing to bring either of these claims, then it might not have to go back to Judge Hannon except with instructions to actually dismiss the case. But if, for example, the Fifth Circuit were to hold that Texas has standing but fails on the APA claim, then it would have to go back to Judge Hannon, I assume, for a determination of the other claim, the constitutional claim. Is that right to you, Ian?
That does sound right to me, yes.
And just add one final wrinkle, and again, like I said at the outset, this is the kind of procedural posture of this case is kind of a labyrinth right now, but it's also possible, despite the unlikely, maybe the diminished likelihood given the nature of the judges on the panel tomorrow, it's still possible that they could rule that Texas did not have standing to bring this case in the first place. And so that would be the best case scenario for the people who want to see these programs go into effect, is that this panel tomorrow could reach a ruling that Texas did not have standing and order and send the case back to have it dismissed as well.
Super, thank you so much.
Mark, do we have any other people in the queue?
We have two questions in the queue at this time. Next, we'll hear from Sheena Ellerington, Center for Popular Democracy.
Hi. Thank you all for an incredibly informative presentation. This question was partially asked by the prior person. Could you guys give an estimate, if at all possible, of the time frame that we're looking at and kind of the best and worst scenarios for the three parallel or three proceedings that you just mentioned?
That's a really hard question. For the emergency stay, my prediction is weeks and not months, but that's just, an educated guess. For the preliminary injunction, a lot of that, the appeal of the preliminary injunction, a lot of that could depend on what the panel does on the request for the emergency stay, because if they release a precedential opinion, is very clear about how they view the law, then the panel deciding whether to overrule the preliminary injunction would be bound by that precedential opinion, and that could dictate their answer one way or another. If they don't, this is a complex enough issue that given the nature of the panel, they may take months to consider their opinion. Regarding what's going to happen at the district court level, frankly, Hannon has shown a willingness to drag his feet once he got his preliminary injunction in place. One unusual aspect of this litigation is that the ordinary rule, and this is why it took DOJ such a long time to ask the Fifth Circuit for a stay, the ordinary rule is that a party that seeks a stay from an appellate court must first ask the district judge that issued the opinion that they're seeking to stay if he will stay it. So DOJ filed that request in Hannon's court, and Hannon sat on it, I think for close to a month. At one point he issued an order saying he wasn't going to decide it, or at least for a while. And finally DOJ grew frustrated and said, okay, well, we're going to go to the Fifth Circuit and say, invoking a rarely used procedure that allows them to bypass the district court in these circumstances and ask the Fifth Circuit to act anyway. And once DOJ went to the Fifth Circuit anyway, then Hannon went ahead and denied the request for a stay. So Hannon has shown a willingness to drag things out. And, you know, part of the problem is that, you know, if DOJ loses at the emergency stay level and if they lose at the preliminary injunction level, then they won't have the ability to appeal Hannon's decision on the merits until Hannon actually decides the case on the merits. Until he does, the preliminary injunction stays in place. So you risk having a situation where that trial drags on for however long it drags on, and DOJ doesn't have an order from him that they can then run up the chain.
Mm-hmm. Although, just to be clear, they could appeal the preliminary injunction to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's a very good point. They could also appeal a denial of the emergency stay to the Supreme Court.
Hey, can I just add, this is Steve, this, I think this reveals an extraordinary feature of our federal judicial system. You could have 20 lawsuits brought to enjoin the president's deferred action program in different courts, and 19 of those could be dismissed on the merits. But if even one district judge with extreme political views like those of Judge Hannon were to issue an injunction, it can shut down the whole program for a very long time. And that's the kind of frustrating situation that we're in now.
And I'll just add to that, like, that's the reason why the ordinary rule is that a district judge's decision over enjoining the entire United States is stayed as a matter of course.
Mm-hmm. Great, great stuff. Okay, Mark, next question.
Thank you very much. And as a reminder, to ask a question today, star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our next question will come from Ariane DeVogue with CNN.
Hi, guys. Sorry, I missed the very tip-top of the call, and I just want to make sure I'm clear. At tomorrow's hearing, it's really only about the emergency request, so it would only get into APA and standing, and you doubt seriously that they could rule from the bench, say, on standing or not? I'm just trying to think. I'm not thinking past tomorrow and what could happen, you know, at the hearing.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Steve, you want to take it? No, Steve, why don't you go and then Ian can follow?
I was just going to say, Ariane, what you said is correct, but in order to decide whether to grant the stay, one of the things they have to look at is how likely the government is to prevail on either the standing issue or the APA issue. So they will have to get into those issues just to decide the stay. And in addition, as Ian mentioned a moment ago, once they do that, then if they decide to enshrine their conclusions in a presidential opinion, then the panel that ultimately decides the preliminary injunction appeal would be bound by it.
But from the bench, could they possibly rule from the bench tomorrow? I mean, could you come out of that hearing and say, you know, either A, they're going to lift it for all the other states except for Texas, or B, there's no standing? I mean, could we know that by tomorrow at noon?
I mean, this is the end.
Is that a question?
No, not at all. I think the answer is it's not impossible, but it strikes me as very unlikely. It's unlikely they would have scheduled 2 hours of oral argument if they were already so sure of what the answer was that, like, they're going to go ahead and just issue it from the bench.
Okay. So we don't expect that. And then here's the last part. So whatever happens on this hearing for the emergency request, we expect either side on just the issue of the emergency request to go to SCOTUS?
I would expect that, yeah. I don't know if y'all disagree.
No, I very much agree, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've showed the Department of Justice in this litigation, you know, to this point has showed that they're going to be extremely aggressive in challenging this ruling, and unless there's something that, you know, the three of us aren't seeing about why that would, you know, actually slow their process up, I would expect that at least the federal government side of the litigation to challenge this as aggressively as possible, including taking this, an adverse ruling here up to the Supreme Court.
And I'll just add to that I suspect that part of the reason the administration is eager to get this to the Supreme Court is that if you look at Roberts and Kennedy, their record seemed to be significantly to the left of Hannon's record, Smith's record, and Elrod's record on immigration. So, like, I think they just think they'll get a friendlier hearing from the Supreme Court than they're going to get so far.
And the government would need only one of those two. It wouldn't even need both to give it a five-judge majority.
And could they go to the Supreme Court and say, okay, we want either the emergency crest dealt with or we want petition for cert? Or would that be premature?
So if they went to the Supreme Court, they'd only be able to ask the Supreme Court for the relief that they were denied below.
Okay.
So if they ask the Supreme Court for an emergency stay, or if what they're appealing is denial of the emergency stay, like, I don't think the Supreme Court would have jurisdiction at that stage to, I mean, conceivably there is something called a petition for writ of certiorari before judgment. So conceivably, they could file a petition in the court asking to bypass the Fifth Circuit's hearing on the preliminary injunction. But I don't think DOJ is likely to do that because, like, I think if they lose at the emergency stay level, they'd rather have another bite at the apple and with a different Fifth Circuit panel.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, guys. Mark, do we have any other folks in the queue?
We have no questions in the queue at this time.
All right. Well, I want to thank Ian and Steve. Really interesting, really, really great stuff. I want to thank the folks who are listening in on the call today. And if you have any questions, please don't feel free to reach out to me. I can put you in touch with Ian or Steve if that's preferable. You can also reach out to Tanya, who you received the notice of this call from, and she can put you in touch with one of the three of us. But if there are no further questions, then, again, thank you all for joining us this afternoon, and have a great day. Take care.
And that does conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation.